The first planet outside our solar system was discovered more than two decades ago. Today, we know of hundreds of so-called exoplanets. It's a cosmic edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first part of the program, we travel to the red planet within our solar system with University of Iowa astrophysicist Jasper Halicus to learn about MAVEN. That's a NASA mission to find out what happened to Mars water. Then we'll be joined by astrophysicist Steve Kowaler of Iowa State University. He'll give us an update on the bounty of recently discovered Earth-like planets in our corner of the Milky Way. That's all coming up after a look at the hour's news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour we spend in space. Later in the hour, we'll find out about more Earth-like planets that have been recently discovered in our galaxy by talking with Iowa State University Professor of Physics and Astronomy Steve Kowaler. We have Steve on from time to time to update us on NASA's Kepler mission. Kepler, if you remember, is the first attempt to look for Earth-like planets in our part of the Milky Way. But first, we start closer to home, closer to Earth, the third planet in our solar system, to talk about the fourth planet out from our sun, the so-called red planet, and another NASA mission. Now, if you look at the surface of Mars, it resembles a planet once teeming with streams and flowing rivers. So where did all that water go? Some of that water, we know, is locked in the red planet's polar ice caps. What about the rest? Scientists have hypothesized the other Martian water could have gone either below the surface or out into space. And that's where a new NASA satellite orbiting Mars comes in. It's called the Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution Mission, MAVEN for short. It was launched in the fall of 2013 and arrived roughly a year later to orbit the red planet. It will not land on the planet. Jasper Halicus is with us, physics and astronomy professor at the University of Iowa, brand new to the university, in fact, in 2014. He's the principal investigator on MAVEN, on a MAVEN instrument, I should say, called the Solar Wind Ion Analyzer. Jasper Halicus, welcome to our program, and welcome to Iowa.
Thanks very much, Ben. Appreciate it.
So you are the principal investigator on this MAVEN instrument that looks at the solar wind. What does that have to do with the question of where Mars water went?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question because it's the whole reason for my instrument existing. As you mentioned, the instrument measures the solar wind, being very descriptively titled as the Solar Wind Ion Analyzer. You might be wondering what the solar wind is. The solar wind is a supersonic stream of hot ionized gas that's constantly flowing out from the sun. It's mostly ionized hydrogen, which is otherwise known as protons to some of us. So that's the primary measurement that we're making, is this stream of plasma flowing out from the sun, going very fast, going about 1 million miles an hour. All of that energy coming off of the sun is blasting into the atmosphere of Mars, and it deposits a lot of energy in that atmosphere, and we believe it deposits enough energy in some cases to actually give the particles escape velocity, in other words, to allow part of the atmosphere of Mars to be blown off by this wind.
So blows outward, further out into the solar system.
Yep, lost to Mars forever.
Okay, so the natural question would be here, why do we have oceans full of water? Why isn't our water perhaps being blown out into the solar system?
Well, it's a fantastic question, and it's actually, you know, in terms of the big picture questions that we hope to address with MAVEN, one of the big things that we're really trying to get at is why do these three planets, Venus, Earth, and Mars, that are being constantly bombarded by all this energy from the solar wind, look so different today? Mm. They're not that far apart in the grand scheme of things. You know, they're all relatively close into the sun. They're all getting hit by similar amounts of energy. They're all relatively similar sizes, and yet they look so different today. Venus is a horrific, hot greenhouse.
Closer to the sun.
Closer to the sun, a little bit bigger than Mars. Mars is a little bit further out, a little bit smaller. It's cold and dry and has no atmosphere left. And then there's the Goldilocks planet Earth, which is still quite nice.
Yeah. Okay. So tell us a little bit more about the solar wind. It's out there. It's been now a couple months in orbit around Mars. And you're receiving data?
Yeah. So we turned on the instruments actually for a little while in cruise while we were still on our ways to Mars. As you mentioned, it's almost a year from when we launched to when we get to Mars. We kind of take a long spiraling loop around the sun and cruise in and match orbits with Mars. And then we entered orbit around Mars in October of 2014. And since then, all the instruments have been on and taking data. For a long time, we were doing what's called commissioning, which is basically turning on all the different parts of the spacecraft and running tests and making sure everything is working. We passed that with flying colors, and we've now started our science phase. And we've been in our true science phase, taking science data now for about a month.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of data are you getting?
So we have a whole suite of instruments on the spacecraft, and they kind of break down into to three different groups. One of them is the group that my instrument is part of, which is measuring all the energy input to the system, mainly from the sun, in the form of solar wind ions and electrons, in the form of essentially sunlight. Photons from the sun is actually a large energy source to the atmosphere. Then we have another set of instruments, which is actually measuring the atmosphere itself, measuring what particles are there in the atmosphere, how they're moving around, what their dynamics looks like. And then the third and perhaps most important set of measurements is the measurements of the escaping particles, what particles are actually getting out of the system and being lost for good. Now, what we hope to do, of course, with MAVEN is to connect up all those three to understand how the loss of particles from the system depends both on the reservoir of the atmosphere and on the energy input from the sun.
Jasper Halicus, when we talk about space weather, we know weather beneath our atmosphere, next to the surface of the Earth. How does space weather affect us here on Earth?
Well, that's a fabulous question, too, and it's a very active area of study at NASA. There are historical reasons to think that it could be very important. Not necessarily the sort of quiescent normal solar wind that we see every day, but the more extreme events could have implications for our life here on the surface, actually. There was an event called the Carrington event that happened in the late 1800s where a giant CME exploded out from the sun and impacted the Earth.
CME?
Coronal mass ejection.
Okay.
Thanks for the clarification. it's easy to get sidetracked in jargon in these conversations.
Right.
Coronal mass ejection, which is basically just a big blob of hot plasma coming out from the sun, carrying very strong magnetic fields with it. This impacted the Earth, and because of the impact of this event, the magnetic field of the Earth was changed enough that there were very strong currents created in the Earth's ionosphere. Now, of course, there are things going around on the surface that will pick up those currents, things like telephone wires, things like electrical systems. And in fact, during this event, telephone wires across the Midwest caught on fire.
In the 1800s?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. There were aurora borealis seen in the tropics during this case. So this was a really, really extreme space weather event. And there's nothing saying that one of these will hit us again or that it won't. But we'd sure like to know whether something like that was coming and understand how we could make our electrical systems less vulnerable to these kind of events.
Basically, how is the Martian atmosphere different than Earth's atmosphere?
That's a good question, and it's getting far from my area of expertise.
It is, sorry.
But it's the composition is rather different, and it's much, much thinner than the Earth's atmosphere. They do interact with the very top layer of the atmosphere much more directly than they do in the case of the Earth. The Earth, of course, as you know, has this large magnetic field that in many ways we think serves as a barrier to the solar wind and prevents it from interacting as much directly with the atmosphere as it does at Mars. Mars actually has small magnetic fields, but it doesn't have a big global magnetic field like the Earth does. It has some little patches of magnetized crust on the surface that don't serve as quite an effective shield in the way that the Earth's field does.
Mm-hmm. So what is this early data telling us, telling you and the other researchers on this project about the outputs, whether that question that you raised before, whether the solar winds passing by Mars, hitting Mars, are removing or have in the past removed water?
Well, we're still very much in the early stages and understanding the data sets that we're looking at. But one thing that we're seeing is that the atmosphere is tremendously dynamic and structured. It's not just sitting there in a quiescent state. It's being stirred around and turned upside down. There are huge density waves that we see, large perturbations of the atmosphere and wave-like structures. And we're seeing lots of particles escaping from the planet. We're seeing lots of energy coming into the system from the sun. It's been a very variable period in terms of space weather, if you will. Mm-hmm. The solar wind coming at the planet has varied in velocity over a factor of 2 or 3. It's varied in density over a factor of at least an order of magnitude while we've been there. Now we're still connecting up the dots to see how those escaping particles that we see depend on what's coming in. You know, that's the whole goal of the whole mission, and it's going to take us a little while to get there. But what we're seeing so far is a really dynamic system, and we're certainly seeing that portions of the atmosphere are being stripped off into space. Mm-hmm. Whether that's enough to explain where all the atmosphere that Mars had 3.5-4 billion years ago is a story that we're still writing.
Mm-hmm. So, but the hypothesis is 3.5-4 billion years ago in Mars' past, there would have been a great deal of water on Mars that would have formed the features that we can see on its surface, the canals.
Yes, if you like. more to the point, we see a lot of things that look like there was flowing water on Mars. There's a lot of things that look like gullies and canyons. We also see areas that look like there may have been standing water on Mars. There was recent data that came out from Mars Science Laboratory and some of the other rovers on Mars that there may in fact have been standing bodies of water on Mars. Imagine mm-hmm. imagine lakes and oceans on Mars in its very, very early
history. In liquid form or solid?
In liquid form.
Hmm. Now back in 2010, President Obama announced his intention to send human explorers to, first, I guess, to a near-Earth asteroid by 2025, and then to Mars sometime in the 2030s. Is your work relevant to that mission? I imagine understanding Mars must be relevant to an eventual manned mission to Mars.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, we're doing the weather forecast at Mars right now. We're telling you what the weather looks like. So certainly it's an important part of understanding what Mars looks like as a terrestrial planet. And I think that if and when we ever get to the point of sending people there, they're going to be looking back at these data sets to make sure they understand what they're getting into.
Mm-hmm. Why else does this research matter? Outside of curiosity, we want to know about everything in our solar system, and the past of Mars is important there. What more relevancy does it have for us Earthlings?
Well, part of it is what you said. Nature is doing it, so it's interesting to study. But in a bigger picture, one thing is, as we mentioned, how did these three near-sun planets evolve into such different places? How did we end up in a greenhouse on Venus, a desert on Mars, and a lush tropical planet like the Earth? And are we in any danger of the Earth ever turning into one of these other extremes?
Mm, okay. So what is the life expectancy of MAVEN? You said all systems go, all the instrumentation is working correctly. How long will it be orbiting Mars?
We hope for a very, very long time. We designed the spacecraft and all of its systems to last for as long as they possibly can. And we have enough fuel on board that the mission could last for 10 or more years. Now, we're only guaranteed of being there for one Earth year. When we proposed this mission, we proposed a one Earth year mission because we believed that we could accomplish all the top-level science in that time. But we hope that we'll get to stay on longer than that, and that'll be up to NASA. They'll look at our mission and determine whether we're still operating, at 100% efficiency and returning good science data, and they'll make the determination of whether we get to stay on longer than that. But we certainly hope so.
Mm-hmm. Now, your colleague, physics and astronomy professor Don Gurnett, has been on this program several times. He's a co-investigator on something called Mars Express. It's a European mission that has been studying this planet, Mars, and its water riddles since 2003. How does your work fit together with his? You work with him?
Yeah, absolutely. So Don's office is about 3 floors above mine, almost directly above my office, and we walk up and down the stairs fairly often to talk to each other because our work overlaps a lot. Mars Express and MAVEN being there together at the same time is a really unique opportunity, actually, because no spacecraft can be in 2 places at once. So having 2 measurements at once is extraordinarily valuable. One, it allows you to see what different parts of the system are doing at the same time. But also there's some complementary instruments on the 2 spacecraft. So Don has an instrument on Mars Express that's a little bit different from what we have on MAVEN and makes slightly different measurements. So combining those 2 data sets could be very fruitful, and we're very much looking forward to doing that.
Mm-hmm. Do you keep track of all the missions around Mars? I don't know how many instruments from Earth are orbiting Mars or on the planet.
I'm not going to embarrass myself by trying to count them all up right now. But yeah, I think there's three or four orbiters and there's at least three rovers on the surface now. So it's actually a bustling place.
Okay. We'll look forward to updates from you as more data comes in. Jasper Halicus is a physics and astronomy professor at the University of Iowa. He's a principal investigator on a MAVEN instrument. MAVEN is the Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution mission. And it just arrived in the fall of 2014, orbiting Mars. And he is the principal investigator on a MAVEN instrument called the Solar Wind Ion Analyzer. And Jasper, thank you for coming into our studio.
Thank you very much.
It's an outer space edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Now with us, Iowa State University Professor of Physics and Astronomy, Steve Kowaler, and to continue with our cosmic discussion. Steve is affiliated with NASA's Kepler mission. He joins us from time to time to talk about that mission, which he is affiliated with. The mission of this space telescope, Kepler, which was launched back in 2009, was to look for Earth-like planets in our part of the Milky Way. Steve, welcome back to our program.
Hi, it's great to be back, Ben.
And when we reach out to our listeners for the remainder of the hour, Steve will be with us. What are your questions about the Kepler Space Telescope mission? What are your questions about Earth-like alien worlds? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Steve, let's start off. You better remind us what qualifies as Earth-like in this mission.
Well, the definition of Earth-like is ever-changing and ever-broadening as we've been finding planets that are more or less like our Earth. But the bottom line is we're looking for rocky planets, planets that have a nice solid surface, that aren't therefore too big so that they have an enormous thick atmosphere, or too small that they're just frozen solid. The second aspect besides size is they need to be just the right distance from their home star. In the Goldilocks zone as Jasper was talking about, that is close enough to the star that it's warm enough that water doesn't freeze, but not so close that the planet heats up to the point where all the water will boil away. By keying on water, we key on the essential ingredient for life. We think that life depends on having abundant liquid water present. And so by looking for planets that might have liquid water at their surface year-round, that's how we kind of think of a planet as being Earth-like.
Now, the news, as I followed it in the popular science press, and I know your research is in a little different quarter, so we'll talk about that a little bit later. But I understand that there are now three, since we last spoke in the spring, three potentially habitable planets joining what is called Kepler's Hall of Fame, which now has eight of these fascinating planetary prospects. Kepler 438b, is that the one that's at the top of the list now?
To be honest, I don't really keep track of the numbers that closely, but Kepler 438 and I think there's Kepler 442 are two planets that are roughly the size of the Earth. They're both a little bit bigger, orbiting a star that's somewhat different than our sun. The stars they orbit are M stars, and by that we mean a star that's a little bit less massive than the sun, a little bit less powerful, so it's a cooler star. So they have to orbit closer to those stars to be considered habitable, and in this case they do. The temperatures of these planets are, again, consistent with liquid water being able to exist on their surface. So those are two of the new members of the hall, as you would call it. There's another one that's been around for a little while, and that's doesn't have a Kepler number yet because it hasn't been fully verified or vetted by the people that do this sort of thing. But that orbits a star very much like our own sun, about the same temperature, same mass as our sun, and it's a year on that planet would last 370 or so Earth days. So that's probably the closest we'll get to a planet around an ordinary star like our sun that's as much like the Earth as we can hope.
Mm-hmm. How far away are the planets you're talking about, these exoplanets?
Do you mean the systems or the planets themselves? The systems, the star plus planets, are somewhere between 500 and 1,000 light years away.
Okay. So when we talk about the things that Kepler can determine, and it's an amazing instrument, but it can only determine so many things from this huge distance. I can't even say huge because it's much bigger than huge, 400, 500, 1,000 light years away from us. Because I imagine this is where misconceptions can creep in when we use phrases like Earth-like alien planets. Because Kepler can only determine so much. What can it determine about a planet and what is really not to be known, at least by this instrument? Can you define that a little more?
Sure. Kepler actually does not observe the planets directly. It looks at the stars that host the planets. And it detects the planets. It knows that they're there in some sense because as the planets cross between us and the star, they block a little bit of light from the star. And so when we say Kepler has found a planet, what that means is we've noticed that a star has had its light drop just a little bit for about 12 hours or so and then has bumped back up as the planet has crossed in front of it. But from that very, very slim piece of information, you can learn a lot about the planet. You can know its diameter. You can know how fast it's going around the star. And if you see several of these dips over time, you can measure the orbital period of the planet, which then tells you how far the planet is from the star.
How in the world do you tell if it's rocky or not?
That's where the physics comes in. Before this, it's all simply geometry. But if you know that the planet itself is roughly the size of the Earth, then another piece of information that you need is the mass of that planet. And if you can somehow dig out the mass of the planet, you know the mass and the size, you can calculate its density. Now, the density of the Earth, the average density of the Earth, is about 5.5 times the density of water, which is a little bit higher than the average density of a rock you'd pick up anywhere. A gaseous planet has a density that's comparable to water or even less. And so if we can guess at the mass of the planet, know the radius of the planet, we can find out its density and then conclude that it must be made of something solid, something rocky.
So that's determined from what is a point of light that's not even visible to the naked eye.
In most cases, yes. These stars are faint enough that you need at least binoculars to see them.
Now, are all the things detected by Kepler actually, you talked about verifying actual planets?
No, actually, most of them are not. There's a lot of other things that can make the light of the star dip slightly and then come back up again. Kepler isn't very precise in terms of taking very sharp images. And so when we say we're looking at a star, we're actually looking at a region of space surrounding a star. Behind the star or in front of the star, there might be a second star close to it. And it's possible that that second star close to it is what we call an eclipsing binary. And so the little dip in light of that other star is what we're attributing to the star that we think we're looking at. Mm-hmm. So when we see a dip in some Kepler data, we have to go to a bigger telescope and make sure that there's no other stars near the candidate. If that's the case, then the small dip can only be caused by a small body like a planet.
So it's almost like a police lineup. You have these up there and you start ruling them out. He couldn't have. That must. And then you if there's someone left there at the end of the ruling out, then it may be a planet.
That's right. It's circumstantial evidence until you find the smoking gun or the piece of evidence that locks it. And that piece of evidence that locks it is typically obtained by a much larger telescope, one of the 10-meter telescopes in Hawaii, for example, that takes a spectrum of the star and can measure the motion of the star induced by the planet.
Steve Kowaler, stay with us, Iowa State University professor of physics and astronomy, updating us on the Kepler mission, which he is affiliated with, launched back in 2009 to look for Earth-like planets in our part of the Milky Way. Steve's work is affiliated with NASA's Kepler mission. We'll talk about that when we come back. Also, we want to get an update from Steve about the handicap that Kepler has. We'll tell you about that when we come back. Join our discussion. Your questions about the Kepler mission, about Earth-like alien worlds. 1-866-70-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. And we're back with this cosmic edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. My guest for the rest of the hour, Iowa State University professor of physics and astronomy, Steve Kowaler, affiliated with NASA's Kepler mission. And we're talking about the new planets discovered by Kepler, actually going through years, a backlog of data that goes back years. And now there are, I guess, 8 planets in the Kepler's Hall of Fame, prospects that are very Earth-like in the characteristics that have been laid out by the Kepler Space Telescope mission. If you'd like to join our conversation, what are your questions about the Kepler mission, about Earth-like alien worlds? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk or find us on Facebook. Now, Steve, last time we spoke in March of last year, I believe, we were getting used to the idea of a broken spacecraft. Kepler Space Telescope was ailing. What was wrong with it?
Well, the telescope itself was fine. It was the pointing mechanism that was hobbled. Kepler needs to point very precisely in order to do its work. For the first 4 years of its mission, it looked at a single piece of the sky, in our summer sky, in fact, and that was its design. But the reaction wheels, sort of like gyroscopes that help keep it oriented in the three free dimensions, as long as they were working, it could point just fine. It was launched with four, an extra, that one of them failed soon after launch. But then with three, it was fine for 4 years. Without three, with only two, it could point in two of three directions. Okay, it has to point up, down, left, right, and constrain the roll, sort of like any kind of spacecraft. For each of those, up, down, left, right, and roll, you needed a reaction wheel. And with only two reaction wheels, you could only constrain it up, down, left, right, or up, down, roll, or any combination of those two. So we were worried because in order to look anywhere in the sky without drifting, you need three reaction wheels. We only had two.
So how did you fix it or cope with it?
Well, I should say, first of all, I had nothing to do with the fix. The fix came from a very talented group of engineers at Ball Aerospace, which built the spacecraft originally, and at NASA. They figured out that all we had to do was come up with a way of constraining one of those three motions that didn't involve a reaction wheel. And what they eventually identified, these rocket engineer types, was light from the sun itself. The light flowing from the sun, sort of like the solar wind that was talked about at the beginning, the light from the sun is a steady stream of energy. And that can impact in the metaphorical sense, the motion of a spacecraft. It can push a spacecraft around. And so what the engineers were able to do was find an orientation of Kepler, a pointing of Kepler, where the light from the sun limited how much it could roll. Now, it couldn't do that anywhere in the sky. The telescope had to be pointed in one particular direction with respect to the sun, but when it was pointed that way, the roll was limited by the light from the sun. And so if we gave up pointing Kepler where it had been pointing for 4 years and pointed it where it was stable, we could continue to use the telescope and the photometer, the instrument, just like we had before.
Where is Kepler right now?
Kepler is only about 60 million miles from the Earth right now. It's orbiting the sun as the Earth is, but it's falling behind by design. With this new mode of operation, it became a new mission that we call the K2 mission, and we can point it along the Earth's orbit around the sun in a particular direction depending on what time of year it is. So right now, I'm not sure exactly where it's pointing, but I do know it's pointing somewhere on what we call the ecliptic, which contains all of the constellations of the zodiac.
Craig from Cedar Rapids asks, how do you really know it's planets causing the stars not to shine as bright? How do they know it's not solar flares?
That's a good question. Sometimes stars have spots just like our sun has spots, and when a sunspot or a star spot crosses the disk as the star rotates, that can drop the light of the star pretty much at about the same amount as a planet does. The difference is a planet goes a lot faster across the disk of a star than a sunspot or a star spot would. So a star spot would take, in the case of our sun, about a half a month, 2 weeks to cross the disk, and we would see that as a drop in the light that lasted 2 weeks. The planet crossing the star does so in a matter of hours, and so we can rule out anything close to the surface of the star, on the surface of the star that way.
It's amazing. The light that is reaching the telescope is several hundred years old.
That's correct.
Let's talk. You're affiliated with the NASA's Kepler mission, but up to this point, we haven't been talking directly about what you're doing. So tell us about your research with Kepler and what excites you most at the moment.
Well, like everyone, I'm excited about the prospect of finding a planet like the Earth, a habitable planet, and Kepler is a first step in that direction. But on the science side of things, my expertise is studying stars. And remember, Kepler isn't looking at planets. It's looking at stars and seeing the effects of planets. So all of these data that are coming from the 150,000 stars that Kepler looked at for those 4 years, or the 30,000 stars per pointing in the K2 mission, all that data is data on stars, which makes me excited because my own research looks at star quakes, star vibrations, which are very, very subtle vibrations of a star on timescales of minutes to maybe a few hours.
Star quakes, you said?
Star quakes, yeah. Mm. Subtle, more like ocean waves, but on a star. So they're not devastating to the star or any creatures living on the surface of the star. They're just subtle vibrations. And those vibrations give us a way of probing the insides of the stars, just like when an earthquake happens. We can use the vibrations of the Earth to probe what the structure of the Earth is. Stars do the same sort of thing if you can measure their brightness very precisely. And that's exactly what Kepler does for the purpose of looking for planets. So when it's not finding planets, it's a wonderful starquake meter. And we use those observations to see for the first time inside stars that are like our sun and stars that are very different from our sun.
So what have you found that's in analyzing this light from stars that's been a surprise or excited you?
Well, one of the things we can do is look at not just stars like our sun, but stars that represent what our sun will be like long in the future when we're all long gone. Billions of years from now, the sun will run out of its primary fuel, which is hydrogen, and it will swell up to become a red giant. When it does that, the size that it gets to could be enormous. It could be almost as large as the Earth's orbit. So if you imagine our sun growing and almost licking the surface of our Earth, that's the kind of size that these stars
we would obtain. Just be, I mean, the planet would just be gone. It would be
well, we vapor. would be toasted. Whether the planet survives or not is a key question. If the star, if our sun in the future grows to be as big as the Earth's orbit, sure, the Earth would probably not survive. But if it only gets to be about the size of the orbit of Venus, then the Earth could survive. What we can do with Kepler is look at these stars on their way up and see what's going on the inside of the star. And since the size that the star gets depends on what's going on the inside, we can use star quakes to measure what's going on and compare that to what our computer models say. And what we're finding is stars aren't behaving the way our computer models said they should.
Mm, in what way?
Well, the interiors of these stars that are swelling up are rotating. They're rotating at a different rate than the outside. And that gives us a way of figuring out where the nuclear burning is going on in the star, because that's going to go on close to the place where the velocity, the speed of spin goes up. And so we have this new handle on the relative size of the envelope and the inner core, which then translates into a measure later on of how big the star will eventually get.
Iowa State University Professor of Physics and Astronomy Steve Kowaler is with us in our Ames studio. He's affiliated with NASA's Kepler mission. As he's been listening, he's been talking about his research into star light that's been collected by Kepler and star quakes and such things. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPRTalk. Or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook to ask a question or make a comment. Now, Steve, I'm going to spring this on you. We didn't let you know about this beforehand. That's the nature of a pop quiz. It's our version of Name That Tune, except this is I'm going to play a bit of audio, and it's going to be Name That Recent. It's not hard, Steve. Don't sweat. Name That Recent Blockbuster Sci-Fi Flick, and let's hear a little bit of audio from it.
There's not a planet in our solar system that could sustain life in the near stars over 1,000 years away. I mean, that doesn't even qualify as futile. Where'd you send it?
I've got it ready.
Cooper, I can't tell you any more unless you agree to pilot this craft. You're the best pilot we ever had.
I barely left the stratosphere.
This team never left the simulator. We need a pilot, and this is the mission that you were trained for.
Oh, without even knowing it? An hour ago, you didn't even know I was alive. I mean, you were going anyway.
We had no choice.
How long will I be gone?
Hard to know. Years?
I've got kids, Professor.
Get out there and save them.
Okay, the unmistakable voice of Michael Caine along with Matthew McConaughey. And your answer is?
That's got to be Interstellar.
You're right. I wish I had a bell to ring. I don't have a bell or a buzzer or something like that. I'm assuming you saw this film.
I did. I did the first week it was out, in fact.
And so tell us, it's been called one of the most realistic science fiction films ever. Would you go with that?
It was pretty good. The treatment of general relativity, what happens when you get close? Well, wait, we should probably issue a spoiler alert, maybe?
Okay. Spoiler alert. Let's get a it'll be similar to the red alert sound on the Enterprise. Okay. It's been sounded. Spoiler alert. Go
Terrific.
Ahead.
The treatment of general relativity and what goes on near black holes was as realistic as one could make it, I would guess. Obviously, you have to make compromises. That part of it was pretty good.
What about this idea of a wormhole to another part of the galaxy? We know light travels at a certain speed, very mm-hmm. fast, but still we could not escape a certain very small part of our galaxy, certainly within a lifetime, unless we can go faster than the speed of light, which Einstein says doesn't happen. So we have these wormholes. Do they exist, at least theoretically?
Theoretically, they can exist. There are some issues about stability. Once they're produced, how long will they last? But there are also some ideas about if we can produce them artificially, how we can allow them to continue to exist. This is a problem not just with the physics. It's also a problem with the engineering side of things. Engineers are brilliant and industrious, but they can't get around the basic laws of physics. So until we've untangled the physics, the engineers have to wait a little while.
What about the weird things that happen in this movie regarding time? Time slowing, mm-hmm. People aging faster than others in the film?
That was done quite well, in fact. Again, anyone who has not seen the movie, this will spoil some parts of it. But there is a set of scenes where a few astronauts leave a base ship and go close to a black hole or a planet that is close to a black hole, and for them, time continues to pass by normally. But for the colleague they leave behind, time goes normally as well, but he sees the people who come back at a much later time. And that's a real general relativistic phenomenon, that time goes slower near a black hole when viewed from the outside.
Is there an easy way to tell us why that should be, why time would slow and speed up depending on how close you were to a black hole?
Well, if you could see my hands moving around, that would make it a lot easier. But in short, it's a consequence of Einstein's original idea for special relativity, and that is the speed of light, which is the speed limit, the universal speed limit, is the same measured by anybody anywhere in the universe, no matter how fast they're going or how slow they're going. And a consequence of that is that near an intense gravitational field, time has to slow down in order for the speed of light to be the same measured close to that heavy object compared to far away.
Okay.
So time is fungible, space not so much.
1-866-780-9100. Let's go to, in the remaining minutes, let's go to a call from Fred in Grinnell. What is your question about Earth-like alien worlds?
Well, two questions. What's the chance there's any precious metals on asteroids or on these other planets that we may never, ever see?
Okay, let's take that one first of all. Precious metals is what I think I heard on these other places. Well, we couldn't mine them. They were way too far away. But can we tell anything about the substance these planets are made out of?
The planets around other stars, no. But they're certainly precious metals on objects that are a whole lot closer that we can reach and that we can mine.
So we were talking about mining asteroids, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah. Asteroids, especially the old asteroids, the ones that hadn't been processed, are very rich in things like iridium and rare earths. And so if we could grab one of those, one came close by, that could produce a huge mother load. And that's almost financially feasible these days.
What about finding a large... Well, Fred,
I think we lost Fred.
We did lose Fred. That happens in space sometimes. We lose one of them. Sorry, Fred. Well, what if we would find a huge deposit of, I don't know, gold or diamonds? Would that just, I guess?
That's unlikely, but if we did, I would rather have the iridium, frankly. Oh, that's harder to find.
See, I don't know iridium. It's harder to find more valuable.
Yes.
Now, as I said in the outset, I think it was, you can be more precise, but at least two decades or more ago that the first exoplanet, and by exoplanet we mean a planet existing outside of our solar system, was discovered. And now we have hundreds or over 1,000.